Klemperer comes back to a very similar sort of Blochian idea. He writes, until now, Renan's everything is possible, even God, seemed to me an ironic witticism. I now take it literally and as my religiosity, which I kind of love. He's like, anything is possible. Why should that possibility only ever point towards catastrophe? It could also point towards shocking and sudden release from it. So that's where we leave 1933 on a chilly New Year's Eve. Pretty much everyone wants to have some hope, but they sense that the worst is yet to come. And of course, they are all right.
Yeah.
Hello, I'm Adrian Daw.
And I'm Moira Donegan.
And whether we like it or not, we're in bed with the right.
So Adrian, today is actually kind of a big day for us.
Kind of a big day.
Because this is the final installment of Project 1933, your opus, the project that really, I think, remade this podcast under your direction, under your, you know, stewardship. How do you feel about bringing it to an end?
It's feeling pretty real right now. I gotta say, we've spent a lot of time researching this, talking about this, preparing it, and recording it. I mean, I think there must be something like, 14 to 16 hours of us talking about this 1 year on whatever app you use to get your podcast. That's not nothing. It's also been, honestly, for me, a way to kind of deal with 2025. This is my way of becoming clearer about what I think is happening and what I think is likely to happen next. And then the other thing I should mention is that the other reason I'm thinking about it a lot is that it's not actually going away. Because this is the final part of the podcast, Project 1933, but it's not the end of the project because it's now going to be a book, it turns out.
Dun, dun, dun.
I know. coming at you in October 2026, there's going to be a book called Project 1933 coming out with Astra House Publishers. Subtitle is, as of last week, The Death of Democracy, Then, Now, and Beyond. And yeah, I'm very excited and proud to be working on it. And it means that while I've been researching December 1933 for this episode, I was just in Germany and I was in, I think, 4 different archives trying to pull all kinds of resources, finding some pretty incredible stuff, I think. And so I will not be leaving this year behind, nor will this podcast. We will be kind of veering off into a new direction regarding sort of the Nazis and gender. That's going to be about sort of denazification. Just, you know, call it Project 2027. the thing we all need to be doing in the future. It's like, how did people do it? How did it go? You know? And then I think we're going to do a couple of follow-up episodes as things come up as well.
Before we get into it, I want to ask our lovely and good-looking listeners to please consider signing up for our Patreon. The Patreon is really fun. It's where we get a little weirder and are a little more off the cuff and a little less inhibited because it's behind the paywall. And that is really what allows us to do this. It's what lets us pay our producer, Mark Yoshizumi, to edit us into, like, you know, comprehensible, quasi-intelligent sounding adults. It is what allows us to, like, spend the time doing the research and writing for this podcast. And it's also just a lot of fun.
Yeah. If you can do it, if you can make it work, please consider joining the Patreon.
You could also consider rating and reviewing us on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. That helps more people find us. And yeah, spread the love, spread the good news of In Bed With a Right. So today, you know, we've got a lot to cover. So I thought maybe we could, like, signpost a little at the start. Because one thing I hope we get to do today is catch up with the characters you introduced us to over the course of the past year who lived through, you know, the first year of the Nazi regime and whose experiences we've been sort of, you know, comparing and contrasting with our own, people like Thomas Mann, people like Victor Klemperer, these folks who have, like, narrated the year for us.
Yeah.
I also hoped that, you know, because this is the last podcast episode, we could zoom out a little and think about what has turned out to be really kind of chillingly similar and what has turned out to be kind of surprisingly different or persistently different and see if maybe we can, like, draw any lessons or tentative conclusions about this year. And then I thought, you know, maybe you would want to take us a little into, like, a higher level and look ahead to see what's going to happen to some of these characters we've spent so much time with over the course of the rest of the Nazi regime and, of course, eventually World War II.
Yeah, I think that's a great tripartite way of approaching the topic. We should also mention that we're not releasing on a regular date, and we're going to release on New Year's Eve, hopefully, just as the new year rings in. And I think that some of the differences are going to propel and or inform some of our predictions about what 2026 is going to be like.
Happy New Year, listeners.
Exactly. So tell us what it's like. Yeah.
Your favorite way to ring in the new year, thinking about the Nazis.
Yeah. But we've made it to December 1933. Congratulations, everyone. Big deal. And it's a good month to end on in the sense that this is, for a lot of our protagonists, another month of stocktaking, right? Because in some ways, the measures the Nazis push through at that point and the efforts that the regime sort of undertakes are all about kind of locking in what's already happened, right? So on December 1st, the Nazis, for instance, officially establish a one-party system, which, well, yeah, everyone's like, did you not already do that? It kind of felt like you already did that. On December 15th, there's a reform of the federal structure to further weaken any local opposition. You're like, wait, what local opposition? Like, they're basically just like doubling and tripling down on their control of Germany. And whereas earlier efforts like that often bespeak a degree of insecurity and a lack of certainty about whether or not people were going to go along with this regime, that's no longer the case if you look at their actions. And so Mann, in his diary, for instance, on the 26th of December, talks about basically like the news coming out of Germany and how peaceful it is. And he means that in the worst way possible. He calls it the peacefulness in the regimented and overorganized Germany, particularly evident in its sentimental display during the Christmas season, right?
Tell us how you really feel, Thomas.
Yeah. He's like, the fact that there's nothing coming out is somehow worse, right? It's that like John Mulaney bit about the horse in the hospital. The worst are the days when you hear nothing from the horse. You're like, yeah. What's going on?
Or like it also bespeaks to the defeat and successful suppression of resistance, right?
Yeah.
The Nazis have really successfully consolidated power by Christmas 1933. There's no opposition even for them to abolish. Like they're just kind of making official in law what they have already achieved in fact.
And then the other thing is, of course, that a lot of the questions is like, well, what are we resisting for right now anyway? And Le Mans is very much kind of caught up in that. So on December 4th, for instance, he finds out, I think via the radio, that Stefan Gheorghe has died, who listeners of this pod will know from one of our super long episodes on My Weird Preoccupations, the poet Stefan Gheorghe, you know, right-wing nationalist, but not in a Nazi way, but in a kind of like way that he never actually liked any German rulers.
He was like of a pre-Nazi generation. He was a little bit older. This is, if you haven't listened to our episode on the George Circle, this like crazy right-wing homoerotic poetry group in early 20th century Germany, like look it up. It's a trip. It's so fun.
It's pretty wild. And he's someone who, you know, had half of his circle kind of go Nazi. And the other half being like, oh no, not at all. Why would you ever think that? And everyone else is like, I can absolutely see why they would think that. But Gheorghe himself, he was quite sick already and he couldn't get himself to say anything about the Nazis. And so he went to Switzerland and they kind of reached out to him as they did to Thomas Mann at some point too, I think. And like, we're like, hey, it'd be great to have you. All our poets and artists kind of suck. It'd be great to have someone who actually knows what they're doing, you know? And he just kind of waited it out and was like, I'm just gonna, like the previous Pope being visited by J.D. Vance, he's like, I got only one way out of this and I'm taking it. You'll be visited by three J.D. Vances, yeah. But yeah, I think the reason why Mann, who had always thought Gheorghe was kind of interesting but had never taken him and his group very seriously, why he cared is because, of course, Gheorghe's silence at this point started mirroring his own, right? Mann had initially kind of really taken a leadership role in sort of organizing the émigrés. But in fact, by the late fall, we saw that he briefly considered even going back. He's like, look, I can probably work with these people. And honestly, I'm not sure I'm any more helpful out here than I am in there, right? And he in fact gets into a big fight with his kids over this. His kids, who, as you will remember, have always pushed him to leave and to say why he's leaving. Because he had very much rejected any overtures to join any official Nazi kind of cultural organization. There's one that he thinks about joining now, because it's really much more about like getting paid. He's just published a novel and he's like, look, they have a fund for writers being published in Germany. And basically, Mann sort of thinks like, well, gee, I mean, like, I guess I could at least join that and get paid for this thing. Part of this is that the Nazi press, and I looked into this, like, actually reviewed the novel fairly favorably. He's like, some of it's dumb as a bag of hammers, but like, at the same time, it's all right. And at least they're not burning this book. So he's like, look, I mean, whatever it takes to be in business still as an author in Germany. And his kids are like, absolutely not. Don't join any fucking thing that these people offer you.
Yeah.
And there's real tension there. We'll talk about how he spends his New Year's. But like during the winter of 1933, he has all these visitors. What was striking to me is like how many of the people who sort of cycle in and out of the Mann household now that they've settled down in Switzerland are living in Nazi Germany and are just going to Switzerland to like hang out with him for a day. It's often like other writers, or it's a lot of it is academics. And he's like, oh, they're planning to eventually leave, but not yet, right? So like people, there's starting to be commerce between Nazi Germany and the rest of Europe. And basically people sort of can go back and forth.
And aside from like Jewish-led boycotts, it seems like the international relations are all pretty normal still, right?
Yeah. In fact, Mann seems to think that like the Nazis are basically getting normalized. And that's in fact the real sour note. I mean, I should say that, I should emphasize that while he's thinking about like returning, it's not because he's like, oh, these guys aren't so bad. He's like, these guys still fucking suck.
Yeah.
But I think he's kind of thinking that maybe their bark might be worse than their bite, which, you know.
Yeah. What does that remind me of?
Yeah. history does not vindicate that that assessment of Thomas Mann's. His other assessments of the Nazis are quite spot on, but this one, not so much. For instance, he is like during this month, quite preoccupied with the trial of Ernst Torgler, who's a KPD politician arrested and put on trial for the Reichstag fire, something he had absolutely nothing to do with.
Yeah.
And Torgler is found not guilty by a German judge in December. And Mann's reaction kind of tells you everything about like his view of the justice system. And I think he's generally accurate about this. He calls it a cheaply and cunningly executed maneuver, right? And says like now it's being praised by like the allegedly non-Nazi press as the act of a righteous judge, right? And the Nazi press denounces it. And then he says, and much of the international community is highly impressed by such a display of justice, which is seen as a guarantee of peace, right? And there he's like,
right.
Oh, guys, like, don't fall for this, right?
So, like, they try to frame this random communist flunky for the Reichstag fire. He obviously didn't do it.
Yeah.
And the fact that he's found not guilty is then used, in fact, as evidence of the sort of responsibility and justice of the regime, rather than the fact that he was, in fact, set up for this, which is like which was quite flimsy, right?
Right.
So the bar is very low, is what Thomas Mann is noting.
Yeah, or that people want this to be true, right?
Mm.
Because they think that, well, that means that maybe this regime is mellowing out, right?
Yeah.
Maybe there still is a state of law in Germany. And he's like, I got news for you. Good luck with that. Like, there ain't, and they're not moderating. And so, yeah, so basically for him, that gives you a good sense. Like, he's not looking for signals like, oh, it's getting better over there. He thinks it's terrible. But he's sort of trying to assess his own risk and his own strategy vis-a-vis these people. Doesn't change his opinion of them any. Hey, did you hear that Brett Kavanaugh came out against Kavanaugh stops recently? I don't know why that popped into my head, but it's the weirdest things that kind of come to your mind.
And you do see this in some coverage of the Trump administration or of like sort of Trump-appointed judges whenever they do kind of baseline acknowledgement of the law. It is seen as a great coup for the Constitution, right? Like, look at these checks and balances working.
Yeah, or as a refutation of like, see you hysterical psychos, like you said it was fascism, but that guy didn't get killed. So who's a fascist now, huh?
Yeah. And also like a way to bringing this back to gender, sort of underestimation of the fascist threat, at least in our own time, is always cast as like masculine and reasonable.
Yeah.
And sort of maximalist interpretation of Trumpist ambitions is understood as feminized and a little bit like hysterical and unreasonable.
Yeah.
And the actual correlation of prediction with reality or prediction with like outcomes is sort of not really germane to those assessments, right? The assessment is like the person who seems least scared is most manly and therefore like most credible. And the person who seems most scared is most feminine and therefore most non-credible. Whether or not the fear is justified is like almost besides the point. And it seems like there's something going on here with what Mann is noting in the media treatment of this acquittal, right? It's like, oh, everybody is rushing to downplay the fascists because that sort of lets them off the hook. And it also is just comforting for reality to not, you know, put so many demands on you, right? What if it didn't? What if we could all just sort of exhale?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's it. He is not ready to exhale and he's deeply troubled. And I think living in Switzerland, where it seems like people were quite ready to do this, really upsets him. And he's like, no, like these people will come for you, just so you know, they mean it.
So that's Thomas Mann in Switzerland. How is Viktor Klemperer doing in Dresden?
Not great, not great. So things at the university for him are getting worse. He's got barely any students left. He's always suspected, but he now knows for sure that that's how they'll get rid of him, right? They're not really supposed to fire him because he's a World War I veteran, but he's going to be made redundant by having him have no students. Be like, well, sorry, we can't care. Like, it's an efficiency thing. It's not a race thing, right? Which, like, spoiler alert, it's a race thing, right? Like, but there is a lot of this rhetoric, and especially from people who were nominally not members of the Nazi party or who wanted to just be good Nazis or whatever, right? There is a whole lot of like, oh, I'm sorry, my hand is being forced here by the fact that you have no students. It's like, well, why does this man have no students, right? So he knows that's happening. Basically, every entry has like someone leaving. One colleague of his is trying to flee the country and has sold his house. But the money now has a lien on it because he has to still pay the Reichsleit tax.
What's that?
It's a tax on withdrawing capital from the German Empire, basically.
Does that predate the Nazis or is that something the Nazis put in place?
So this is one of those things in which the late Weimar Republic really fucked people during the Third Reich. Because this was originally a capital control meant to shore up their money supply.
Right.
This was after 29, right? They were like, oh, we can't have everyone run to Switzerland, run to the United States and convert. Otherwise, you know, it's just going to destroy our currency. And so they had created all these capital controls. I believe the U.S. had this too. The problem was that the Nazis were not using it. It was meant to be about like large sums of like business proceeds, I believe, and huge fortunes. And the Nazis used it largely against Jews.
Yeah, the Nazis use it to control like the household income or just like personal assets.
Yeah.
Of individual members of whichever disfavored like racial or ideological group that they're persecuting that week. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a way of fleecing, especially Jewish Germans, but social Democrats too, I guess, to some extent, on their way out, right? It's this highway robbery. They're just like, you know, we will not let you work here. You will have to leave, but you also have to pay us to let you leave.
So like the Nazis are both, are they encouraging emigration of Jews at this point? Are they like, get out of here?
I mean, I don't think there's like an official decree, but like, I think these signs were pretty obvious for anyone to read, right? I mean, the same colleague, I think, has his wife arrested for a day because she's been overheard making anti-Nazi remarks, right? Yet another colleague, he says like his nerves are just gone and has applied for retirement at age 50, right? Like people are getting the message loud and clear what this new state wants to do with them, but I don't know if it's official yet. You know, it's in some ways comparable to the way that, like, the Trump administration wants officially undocumented immigrants to leave, but they also want to make life hell for anyone who looks like they could, in their Nazi-ass minds, be an undocumented immigrant.
Yeah, there's a combination of drives towards, like, very efficient ethnic cleansing, like, get these people out of here. And then there's also the kind of, like, libidinal investments in, like, racial sadism.
Yeah.
And those are not always driven towards the same end, right? Sometimes they're a little bit in conflict. It's like, well, you need the despised minority to be around if you want to torture them, right?
Yeah.
But at this point, like Klemperer is looking around at his colleagues at this university in Dresden, and a lot of them are trying to leave, and a lot of them are really sort of suffering under this regime, and he is being pushed out because he's ethnically Jewish. Is that basically what's happening up and down the academy? Are there people who are like very much being encouraged to stay and move up, like, you know, Aryan mediocrities who couldn't get a job beforehand? Are they now being shoveled into positions, or is it like a broader defunding?
No, this is a big bonanza for non-Jewish Germans who wanted to move up in the world. It's also, as in so many, although not all parts of German society, a real generational shift. It's an easy way for someone who's young and hungry for a job to get that job, right? The eternal grad student can now sort of move up and replace the professor that they kind of didn't like to begin with, right?
I read in Compact Magazine that old white men won't retire and have been insufficiently deferential to young white men who want to break into elite industries. It seems like something like this Nazi purge of the academy of all the undesirables might really help out that guy who wants a job so badly and thinks he deserves one.
Is he the guy who went to a conference and went on the job market once almost and then like didn't succeed?
He interviewed several guys who went on the job market almost and were shocked that they weren't offered tenure track positions in the classics, a thing that definitely exists everywhere now.
Wow. Yeah.
One of the founders of Compact is always, or used to always be before this abortion clinic shut down, picketing an abortion clinic. And I would go do clinic defense and I would yell at this Matthew Schmitz or whatever his name is outside the Planned Parenthood downtown.
God, these people. But yeah, so Klemperer himself is not leaving. And part of it is just like, so his wife's health is still not great. Eva's health is not doing great. He also is building that house that's ruining them currently.
That's right. I forget that he's like also in the middle of a real estate boondoggle during all of this.
I mean, like worst timing. I think he started thinking about this right as the Great Depression started in 1929 and like starts the building, I think, as the Nazis come to power. It's like, Victor, literally, you couldn't have picked a worse time.
Some of Mr. Klemperer's misfortunes are, in fact, his own fault. Like the Nazis didn't help Victor Klemperer. But like, really, you want to buy a house. You want to build a house.
Well, he wants a house.
Right now.
Well, this is not a particularly mobile man. He thinks he's settling down for the rest of his life. I mean, as it turns out, he is, in fact. But yeah, so on December 31st, 1933, the Klemperers just spend it at home alone with their two cats. They've lost a lot of friends, a lot of friends that won't reach out anymore. A lot of friends have left. And so, yeah, they're pretty alone. Mann spends December 31st in Küsnacht in Switzerland. And he has as his visitor, none other than Ernst Bloch, the philosopher, the author of The Principle of Hope, which is kind of a great visitor to have, given that like he's the guy who basically is like letting the fascists steal utopia from us is extremely dangerous. Like it is the nature of the left to contest what exists now, which is also something that I think Mann likes hearing in, at the end of 1933, because like it all feels so fucking set in stone right now. And Bloch is the guy who's like, look, every revolution unseats something that seems set in stone, right? Like it's set in stone until it's not, right? So that's kind of a perfect closer for Mann. His daughter Erika comes over with a friend from Nazi Germany. Then he puts on a record, which is a piano concerto by Mozart, played by Yehudi Menuhin. So kind of perfect. And it's snowing. So nice New Year's Eve in Switzerland. And he concludes in his diary, "What a year since February. My homesickness for the old way of life is, by the way, minimal. I feel almost more of it for Sanary." So that's Sanary-sur-Mer, the place in southern France where he spent nervous days of late summer. Which in retrospect seems to me to be the happiest stage of these 10 months, and for my little stone terrace in the evening when I sat there in the wicker chair and looked at the stars. Mm. It's kind of interesting, right? He's like, I'm already over it. I liked other parts of my exile better. Like, I don't miss Munich, you know?
Now he's having a nostalgia for other earlier parts of his exile as opposed to his old home.
Yeah, and so...
I mean, frankly, it was France. When you're looking back on your year on New Year's Eve and you're thinking, what was the best part? Your trip to the south of France?
Yeah.
Even if you weren't driven there by the rise of fascism in your own country, I think any year that would be a highlight.
Yeah, you're like, shocker, Thomas de Côte d'Azur. You're like, kind of nice, yeah. But it's funny that like, you know, Mann is sort of hanging out with Ernst Bloch in Switzerland. Meanwhile, Klemperer sort of comes back to a very similar sort of Blochian idea. He writes, "Until now, Renan's everything is possible, even God, seemed to me an ironic witticism. I now take it literally and as my religiosity, which I kind of love. He's like, anything is possible. Why should that possibility only ever point towards catastrophe? It could also point towards shocking and sudden release from it. So that's where we leave 1933 on a chilly New Year's Eve. Pretty much everyone wants to have some hope, but they sense that the worst is yet to come. And of course, they are all right.
Yeah. So one thing I wanted to note is that like 1933, as it played out in Germany, sort of proved the Cassandras right. You know, like every step along the way, everybody who claims that the Nazis are going to get foiled somehow, everybody who claims that there's like an actual obvious limit to what they can do, those have not been borne out, right?
Yeah.
The Nazis, they've really achieved this maximal version of government power. They've consolidated their own authority. They've really eliminated their opposition. They've kind of like closed the doors on other political possibilities in Germany. And they did that pretty well and pretty quickly. That was like a maximalist vision of their ambitions for that year that wound up being played out pretty fully.
Exactly. And I think that, yeah, the road to Nazi domination in 1933 is paved with people who told you not to overreact, right? Like that naturally, as you say, like the institutions will hold. Surely they can't come for. Surely they can't do this. Surely they can't. Well, and it's like, well, no, they can do all these things unless someone stops them. And no one stopped them, right? And so those who sort of posited these obvious limits either had those claims blow up in their face or turn out not to have been particularly serious about those in the first place, right? That's people like Hitler's coalition partners who were still in office by the end of 1933, right? And you're like, so it feels like you just didn't mind that any of this was happening. When you said, like, don't panic, it wasn't nothing bad's going to happen, but you were like, I don't mind what's about to happen.
Another thing that you're reminding me of now is that another recurring theme of 1933 in Germany is that there were like non-Nazi parts of the German right that had kind of a bunch of successive opportunities to sort of like stand up or resist Nazi maximalism. And they like basically never do. They capitulated to Nazism pretty quickly, or they just like left the country and gave up on trying to influence political life in Germany entirely, right? There's not really a non-Nazi German right at the end of 1933 because everybody who's like, oh, but I'm not one of those guys, I find them vulgar, whatever, they're out of the scene or they've turned Nazi by now.
Yeah, the acquiescence of right-wing elites to this, and these are not just inside the government, right? There are the coalition partners, but there are, you know, Alfred Hugenberg concludes 1933 as still, I think, like the owner of most newspapers in Germany, right? Like, so this guy could presumably do something, right? You know, the church, the Catholic Church could still do a lot. The army, the police, et cetera, they've all put up almost no resistance whatsoever. And what resistance they will eventually put up really comes out only once the war is so obviously lost in 1944, that they sort of try to figure out how to like save their own asses. So there is just like very little in the way of actual opposition on the right in Germany very, very early on. And I think that's an important sort of zoom out lesson as well. I think the first one you've already mentioned is the fact that the people who seem to be the savvy kind of analysts of 1933 were the ones that would have given you the wrongest picture of what was happening that year, I think. Right down to like, oh, see that one, you know, the Torgler case, that all went fine. See, the Nazis are coming down. See, it's still a rule of law, blah, 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 blah. Don't worry, you guys, right? Like, right down to that. The second thing that I think we can say as a zoom out is precisely the role of these right-wing elites that sort of have two things happening. One is a group that doesn't think of itself as Nazis and therefore sort of stands aside, but still lets all these things happen. And the other try to out-Nazi the Nazis and tries to sort of join them and tries to sort of outdo them at their own game. That's the thing that Heinrich Mann, remember, in that essay on hate talks about. He's like, these people who have to kind of fake it, he's like, that's worse. Because if you're genuinely psychotic, like at least that's genuine, but like these people are like, they don't know their own limits because like it doesn't come naturally to them. There's an element here of elites that have to learn Nazi cruelty and hatred as a second language, as a foreign language. And Heinrich Mann is like, these are the scariest motherfuckers of them all, you know?
my youth contained this guy who was sort of a boss of me and some of my friends. And he was sort of like emasculated and uncomfortable with his own authority and sort of unused to having the capacity to inflict cruelty, which did nothing to diminish his appetite for it, right? So like watching him put on the costume of an asshole domineering boss was this like really grotesque experience that I had. One of my friends was like, God, he wishes he was a misogynist because he's actually too weak to be this like cruel domineering figure. And I feel like that's a experience I've witnessed kind of a lot as I see people sort of try to adopt Trumpian vulgarity.
Yeah.
Or like adopt a kind of like avowedness to the racism that isn't like totally natural to them.
Yeah.
Or try to adopt like a style of like kind of swaggering asshole masculinity. You know, people seem to be putting on this costume of cruelty to try and have more like claim to authority or to power. And that's been like this kind of very strange experience, like watching people do something that is both wrong and unnatural to them.
Yeah.
In the pursuit of power.
I know exactly what you mean. I mean, I think J.D. Vance is a pretty good example for this. And it seems to bear out Heinrich Mann's insight entirely in the sense that they don't know their own limits. Like some people know the kind of limits of their own cruelty. And these people don't because like it's not their own cruelty, right? It's someone else's cruelty. There's this guy, Hans Frank, who will end up being the governor of Poland, basically, under Hitler and will be, you know, absolute butcher there and will be hanged, I believe, at the Nuremberg trials or after the Nuremberg trials. And that guy, he's like a concert pianist, it's all this stuff. Like, this is the kind of guy that Heinrich Mann is thinking of. And you can really tell, like, the German historian and journalist Joachim Fest calls him, I think, like, imitation or like a mimic, like a simulacrum of Hitler. He's like, he just watched this guy and then taught himself how to be like that, right? And he's like, and you can tell that this is not, he doesn't have any genuine core to this, which isn't like, neither of these is better, but somehow the cruelty is even more unhinged if it's just like not actually attached to anything. It's just like purely imitative, you know? Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. So like in some way, the scariest thing are these right-wing elites who are not coming to it genuinely, but like are now falling all over themselves to try and imitate these already absolutely horrible psychopaths and sociopaths in power. The third thing I would like to sort of underline that we've been coming back to, I think, again and again and again, is the idea of 1933 as really a stress test of German democracy, but also an index of how much democracy had already eroded, right? Some of this had to do with institutional structures, right? Like the fact that, you know, the president was sort of appointing cabinets left and right, that Prussia was no longer fully independent, right? That there was all this kind of constitutional breakdown already happening. But some of it also had to do a lot with feelings and the outlook of people who had control of those institutions, right? So for instance, we talked about this Nazi fixation on victimhood and martyrdom. And we've sort of been saying like, gee, it's crazy that people could be in power in all these ways and yet picture themselves as these poor downtrodden victims all the time. And something I think we maybe didn't mention as much is that, of course, martyrdom and victimhood were something that that entire society had basically its brain pickled in since 1918, right? This was something that Germans, I mean, maybe not the communists, but any German to the right of the communists had some reaction to it, some kind of investment in this narrative. And the Nazis were just kind of feeding that, right? You know, the importance of victimhood, the importance of the collective, the importance of violence and suffering as a thing that created this collective, right, seems really important to the kind of potentials that Nazis are able to activate in 1933. To mention briefly again, this guy, Frank, Hans Frank, that guy was too young to be a veteran. But he lost a brother in World War I, right?
Yeah.
And then he had joined a Freikorps during the communist uprisings in Munich in 1919. Meaning, right, it's this thing that we talked a lot about with the SA, that like, it's not like you yourself have necessarily suffered, but suffering has been visited upon you or it's near you or it's never far from you.
Or you have been you know, the ordinariness of your life or its sort of like received conditions are in some way unjust. I'm thinking of like the right wing meme, like this is what they took from you.
Yeah.
With
yeah.
like an AI generated picture of like a busty blonde in a kitchen, you know,
yeah.
like
a Madonna with huge titties.
Yeah. Yeah. There's like a sense of, okay, your entitlement to a more gratifying kind of life has been subverted yeah. by this nefarious they, these others, right?
Yeah.
And there is a project of community making through that sense of deprivation that is central to the American authoritarian project for sure.
Yeah.
And you definitely see a lot of sort of rhyming similarities between, you know, in America, it's just kind of like economic decline and like imperial yeah. decline. And in Germany, it was this like much more immediate and violent memory of total war.
Yeah, but the important thing is that it's not something that the Nazis uniquely serviced. In some ways, they just picked up on something or gave an extreme version of something that really was accepted widely across society. And that is the real problem, that structure of affect, even if the Nazis' specific policies were not broadly recognized, were broadly shared by other parties, these feelings of aggrievement, of, as you say, of them having taken something away from you, of having been stabbed in the back, et cetera, were quite pervasive. Or the fact that the Allies were mistreating Germany, et cetera, right? And another example of this, by the way, is that one of the things that we talked about quite a lot this year is that the Nazis partly overwhelmed the Weimar Republic through their paramilitaries. But the Weimar Republic, especially under Kurt von Schleicher, had largely nursed those very same paramilitaries, hoping to use them to bolster the Reichswehr, right? So this is the other interesting thing. Like, these structures and these institutions outside of the main government that undo this republic are not inventions of the Nazis. They really are inventions of the final conservative-leaning governments of the Weimar Republic, really, right? And so that's the other important similarity, I think, to the U.S. It's not that these are exogenous forces. The call is coming from inside the house for quite some time. And the structures of affect that the authoritarian is able to play on has been part of the overall zeitgeist well beyond sort of far-right voter potentials for quite some time, right? You know, I mean, the example I always give, although this by now kind of aged, is the number of Americans who are not sort of Rambo-loving anti-communists who still can sort of sound like the Vietnam War was something that happened to American GIs. And it's like, I'd love to interest you in the, you know, several million people who that war also happened to who you don't seem to give a shit about. And the ability to visit violence on another country and then spend years making beautiful films about, admittedly beautiful films about how much you were a victim of it. It's like, okay, that's a choice.
Yeah, how hard it was on you to yeah. commit that violence. Yeah.
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 Yeah, genocide will really fuck with your love life. Yeah. But there's just like a toxic stew that the Nazis are able to activate, but it's a toxic stew that they didn't create. It's a toxic stew that was widely shared, including among people that were very much opposed to the Nazis, but they were able to play on this kind of general toxic atmosphere. Mm. The other thing I wanted to highlight for our listeners as a kind of through line is this question of grief and avoidance. How I think one way to think about 2025, I think for a lot of us who are not Nazis, is that it's been a year of grief, right? There's a lot of, you have to say goodbye to things that you thought you knew about the world. You have to say goodbye, bid farewell to people who you thought were your allies and who would have your back and who would obviously stand up for what's right, even if you didn't politically agree with them. And with some exceptions, you know, I will honorably mention Bret Stephens, who I think wrote a column calling for a general strike. I'm like, okay, Bret, like, so this is more of this. This is good.
Some people have surprised you, but a lot of people have disappointed me.
Exactly.
A lot of institutions
yes.
who didn't need to have cooperated with Donald Trump. A lot of people who have professional or like personal cushion to absorb a blow of defying the administration have chosen not to.
Yeah.
A lot of people who have professed principles that you think would lead them to opposition, you know, quite vocally to things that are happening in this country have been, you know, either silent or actively complicit. And that's been like really heartbreaking.
Yeah. That's an experience that I think a lot of Germans in 1933 would have recognized, right? their workplaces transformed, their public representatives either gone or having basically swerved far to the right. There's a wonderful book by Sebastian Hafner, who's this journalist, this German journalist and historian, who was not Jewish and in 1933 was basically studying to become a lawyer. And so he was like, I'm sticking around, though he kind of knew he was going to immigrate, but he stuck around because he was like, well, I at least need to get my degree in case this ever blows over. And he wrote this book, translated as Defying Hitler. He wrote it in 1939, once he was in England, but he never published it. And it concludes with 1933. And he describes that year as one of slow self-debasement and accommodation, including his own. And he's like, I mean, he's a confirmed anti-Nazi. He tells this story about how in October, I think he's supposed to sit for his, was essentially his bar exam in November. And so in October, the Nazis make everyone go to this sort of summer camp for all the aspiring judges and lawyers. And it's basically an NSA camp. And he tells a story that an Austrian girlfriend visits him the week before, and they're walking down the street in Berlin, and he sort of pushes her into a street. He's like, what's going on? And he's like, oh, let's get off the main street. There's an NSA troop coming. And she's like, well, so? And he's like, well, do you want to Hitler salute them? And she's like, no. And he's like, well, we'd have to. So like, we're not gonna. And so we're going this way, right?
Wow.
And so cut to like 2 weeks later, he's in this camp where basically it's a summer camp. It's like he's describing it as like they don't even like really like talk to them about Nazism. They just kind of have them sing songs and shit.
Mm-hmm.
But they have to march all the time. And he was marching down this country road, and suddenly he sees people darting off the road so as not to have to salute him.
Yeah.
Right? And he's like, fuck, there we are. Right? Like, I was afraid of these people the same way these people are afraid of me now. And of course, like, what am I going to do? How am I going to signal? Am I going to wink at them? Like, you can't signal this. Like, you are at that point part of the state, right? And he describes this as like the depth of his own self-debasement. He has to go through with it, he feels. But that to him, it's not the fact that the Nazis did anything to him. It's the fact that the Nazis force him to basically represent them that really messes with him. The way he narrates that year is sort of the absolute descent into the pits of hell. And May, one other thing about him. So Hafner describes himself as then kind of rather conservative and an individualist. And so he also experiences 1933 as a kind of imposition of collectivity, right? So he talks about the fact that they keep on having to like listen to Hitler speeches while doing other things. So they're like shaving or like playing chess and whatever. And so he's like talking about the guy he's playing chess with, and he's like, I feel like he's flinching at the right things. Maybe I should make a joke and see how it lands. But like, right, they're just kind of trying to like suss each other out.
Mm-hmm.
And then something that it made me realize is that so much of Nazi propaganda was about the fact that you had to experience it collectively at your workplace, in school, et cetera, et cetera. And you were always encouraged to monitor each other's reactions. And so on the one hand, you kind of think like, well, gee, luckily we're a little bit more individualistic now and we kind of don't tend to experience things in public or as a collective all the time. But then I had to think about, you know, the obsessive need of some of our media to check out every professor's social media if like some right-wing podcaster gets killed, right? Like, oh, what did they say on Blue Sky, right? Like, this is our version of that, right? Like, to keep feeding us things that they want a public reaction to, and then kind of calling out or brutally attacking people who don't quite measure up to what their ideal reaction to whatever news they were just sharing with us. I think social media very much has replicated in the Trump administration a lot of the kind of functioning of public broadcasting in the early Nazi years, where like, you watch other people assimilate to this new world and your reaction to it will become itself a subject of scrutiny and a possible site of punitive action by the state, right? Note that Klemperer's colleague's wife does go to jail for like 24 hours. It's not long. She was treated okay, she says.
But it's not fun.
Yeah, but
for making an anti-Hitler remark, right?
For like fucking making a joke about Hitler, yeah. I mean, like, that's bad, yeah.
I'm glad you bring up social media because there's something in the way that the right in particular has now like really kind of gotten down to a science, the way to like surveil and weaponize disfavored populations. And I'm thinking specifically of like trans university instructors,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
I feel like every 2 weeks, some little dipshit at like University of the Risen Christ, you know, has their phone out, pointed at a like transgender PhD student just trying to get through this adjuncting gig.
Yeah.
And then they like raise their hand and they're like, well, how many genders do you think there are? You know, like it's entrapment. And
yeah.
When they inevitably get the video that they're looking for, then there are people in elected office who make sure that that video of somebody failing to toe the right-wing party line, who is like usually vulnerable in some other way, is made into a like example in national right-wing media and then loses their job, right? And it's this quasi-ritualized hate experiment. It's like exactly the mirror image of what they accused the left of doing in the cancel culture panic, right?
Exactly.
They weren't afraid of that. They were aspiring to that, that exactly. Nightmare of these like young people who can surveil you and report you and ruin your life for not agreeing with them is something they were very, very, you know, nominally very, very afraid of and now have created and weaponized for their own ends.
Yeah. At the same time, I do think while there are these definite echoes that you're pointing to, I also think people in the 1930s did have different experiences and a different level of comfort with collectivity. That is one of the places where I've been really starting to notice divergences from the story we've been telling and the story we've been living through, which is I did not have on my 2026 bingo card that a bunch of moms in like yoga pants would like get in ICE officers' faces quite so often, right? Like this was a heavily regimented society, right? Like people remembered being at war. People were in unions. People were working in very collectivized ways, right? Like we are in the end like fairly querulous individualists. That's sometimes to our detriment, but it also does make fascism a little bit harder because we're like, what the fuck? No, I'm going to make a joke. I'm going to make a podcast, right?
Yeah.
And there's reason here for hope, I think.
I think one thing that really strikes me as a big difference as we look back on 1933 and compare it to 2025 is that, you know, maybe just because America has this more individualistic culture and this, you know, technologically enabled public discourse that can be very fractious, and maybe just because it's like a bigger country, the MAGA movement has way less support proportionally in the U.S. in 2025 than the Nazis did in Germany in 1933.
I think that's right.
There's just way more people who hate this shit as a proportion of the population in America now than there was in Germany then. And they were able to consolidate power so quickly, not just because they were so brutal to the opposition, but because their opposition was quite small.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, the reason why the right wing is able to, as you say, weaponize these kinds of images is because there are institutions willing to sign on to it. These instructors are getting fired by universities. Their stories are being picked up by The Atlantic and being like, well, maybe they should have been fired or whatever, right? Like from these free speech warriors over at The Atlantic or whatever.
Everybody who signed the Harper's letter now thinks that MAGA is actually doing exactly what they wanted it to do. Yeah. Everybody who signed the Harper's letter thinks it's fine when a trans person gets fired for their speech.
Yeah. So this all has to move through institutions because it can't move through the collective, is my theory. Because, you know, universities hear like, oh God, he made a tweet making fun of Charlie Kirk. Oh God. And then like they fire a bunch of people. And you talk to average people and they're like, yeah, man, like people are going to joke. What do you want? Right? Like in Germany, I think like the power of the collective was greater and it was easier to manipulate. Whereas I think today, the institutions have to step in because of the recalcitrance of the people who will, because of, let's say, the grand juries of the greater DC area that refuse to indict Sandwich Man or whatever. They're just like, fuck it. Like, yeah, he threw that sandwich, but that ice fucker deserved it. But so, yeah, maybe I should briefly give people a kind of outro to this whole project and tell you a little bit about, especially Klemperer's story, and we'll talk about Mann's story a little bit as well. Just kind of what happened to him afterwards. So he and Eva slowly did finish the house and move in as the world darkened more and more around them. His brother Georg moves to the U.S. in 1935, but Klemperer does stay around. He continues lecturing to dwindling handfuls of students until basically he gets fully laid off from the university in 1935, allegedly for lack of student need. And then by 1940, the Klemperers have to leave their beloved house and move into government housing for Jews.
Oh, God.
Government housing. It's someone else's house that the government basically stole from them and then made other Jewish families move into. By late 1941, he's forced to wear the yellow star, right? He writes about that very movingly. On November 1st, 1941, he's trying to buy milk when a group of Hitler youth sort of run after him, calling him names. And then later that day, he's at a plant nursery running errands where a porter notices the yellow star and asks him if he knows his Jewish friend.
Wait, so there's both like malignant and ignorant racism?
Yeah.
That the yellow star attracts is both like, we're running after you, calling you slurs and threatening violence. And also like, hey, do you know this other Jewish guy?
Yeah. You know, he does tell Klemperer that, quote, it doesn't matter about the star, we're all human beings in the end. But he's just like, I'm looking for, like, do you know what happened to my buddy, basically?
Okay, yeah.
And that evening he notes in his diary, every route was now blocked. In fact, we heard from several sources that a complete ban on all immigration has just been decreed on the German side. Besides, a year and a day would pass before the new American conditions were fulfilled, right? The United States was not taking any Jewish people at the time.
Mm-hmm.
No, we must wait here and see what our fate will be.
Oh, God. That's so chilling. That's so terrible.
Yeah.
What does happen to Viktor Klemperer? Because he's, at this point, he's a visible Jew in Nazi Germany with no way to get out.
That's right. In March 1942, a former friend and such an anti-Nazi, he remarks sardonically, named Berger, buys the house from Klemperer's Aryan trustee. He had to have an Aryan hold, quote-unquote Aryan, hold the house in trust. And the guy sold it under him. So they just stole it from him. And that same month, March 1942, there's an interesting note in Klemperer's diary, which I think is both ominous, but also really interesting in terms of like what people knew when about what was happening. He talks about making deliveries to a prison where basically people are being kept before deportation. At midday on Friday, relatives bring underwear for the prisoners in the police cells. As long as the underwear is accepted and exchanged for used underwear, then the man is at least still there. If the underwear is refused, then he has been transported to a concentration camp, right? In the last few days, I heard Auschwitz, or something like it, near Königshütte in Upper Silesia, mentioned as the most dreadful concentration camp. Work in a mine, death within a few days, right? So he's already, they know a taxonomy of these camps. They know these names. So just in case, you know, anyone has German relatives that told them that they had never heard of it, Viktor Klemperer had heard of it in 1942.
So they know that there's some sort of mass extermination happening. Yeah. They know that deportation means death very soon.
That's right. And that's where things stand by 1945. He's still in Dresden. He's living in this group home.
But he does not himself get arrested and deported like other Jews.
Well, he's not free to leave. This house is essentially a prison. But he's there with Eva. And on January 15th, 1945, I thought it was very interesting, Klemperer notes in his diaries a set of news he has received from a, quote, fellow star wearer, an old infirm man named Schwartz, who was freed from labor service and therefore had time to hang out with him. This guy, Schwartz, seems to have access to a radio, and a lot of people are listening to both German radio and, by this point, Allied radio in 1945. And Schwartz tells him exactly what he was hearing. From British radio, basically, he knows that the German counteroffensives in the East and in the West have collapsed. But then he adds that he's heard another really uplifting broadcast, and it's Thomas Mann, recorded all the way in his house on San Remo Drive in Pacific Palisades as part of his German language addresses to Deutsche Hörer, so German listeners. So he records these things in German, saying like, Hitler will lead you to your doom. Rise up. Don't give your lives for these men. And Schwartz can't quite remember everything that Mann said, but says that he felt basically immensely uplifted.
Mm.
He's also very excited to hear from a Jewish-German guy. Klemperer is like, oh, actually, Mann's not Jewish. His wife is.
It's just his wife. He's not even Jewish.
Yeah. And then Schwartz and another friend later also confirms this for him, that Mann is considered an outstanding speaker. And Klemperer comments, news to me.
You gotta love somebody who, under this kind of persecution, this is a Jew living in Dresden in January 1945, is still managing to be a little bitchy and a little petty.
I really, I like the fact that he's like, huh.
Truly, the human spirit persists.
Yes, like, yes. But of course, like, even though at this point Nazi Germany is basically on the verge of collapse, the industrialized slaughter continues.
Mm.
And on February 13th, 1945, there's an order. all Jews in Dresden have to report for deportation, including Jews in mixed marriages, which is the case for the Klemperers. Klemperer at this point has a job where basically he has to deliver the news to various families, I think in these Jews' homes, what they were called, including parents and children. There's this horrifying anecdote he relates where a child asks him to, like, keep her teddy bear, if they have to go. It's really awful. And the trains are to leave on February 16th. Klemperer is not on the list yet, but he knows that he's going to be swept up the week after that. And as you know from that entry, he's fully aware of what this deportation is going to mean. But this is where fate intervenes, because they're all supposed to leave on February 16th. At 9:51 on February 13th, the day he has to deliver these notices, the air raid sirens go off throughout Dresden. It's the Brits and it's the Americans. And Frau Stühler, his neighbor in the Jews' house, remarks, "I hope they smash it all," as they head into the air raid shelter.
As indeed they do. I think our listeners might be a little familiar about what the Allies do to Dresden. It's not pretty.
That is this day.
Wow.
And he, because I think their air raid shelter was further away from their building, he gets to see a lot of it. And because the so-called Jews' house was located in the old town, very center of town, he has basically front row seats to, the destruction of Dresden, the famous Dresden firestorm. He writes, "Suddenly the window on the back wall opposite the entrance burst open, and outside it was bright as day. Someone shouted, 'Incendiary bomb, we have to put it out.' Klemperer gets struck in the face by debris, and a group of Russian POWs, who has no idea where they even came from, help him outside. Basically, they have to leave the bomb shelter. But he's lost Eva. So he finds a fellow inmate with his little son on his shoulder who's looking for his wife and other children. And they shelter in various large buildings and eventually find open space. The old city of Dresden sits on a bit of a bluff above the river Elbe. And I think what they do is, as best as I could reconstruct it, they head to the river away from the flames and from the explosions, where he finds Eva, who's been pulled into the Aryan shelter, the quote-unquote Aryan shelter, when the explosions started. And the raid will go on for 2 days. It's the 13th through the 15th of February. It's the famous one that Kurt Vonnegut immortalized in Slaughterhouse-5. It's famous for both the phosphorus bombs, the incendiary bombs, and the sustained double-tap attacks. So, like, they'd wait for a few hours for people to try and put out the flames and then attack again. Mm-hmm. And the city basically melts more than it burns. Vonnegut himself, I think, witnessed it from just northwest of the city in what's today an exhibition ground. But the Klemperers are right in the middle of it. So that is the moment that really changes Victor's fate. Americans seem to feel bad about this raid, especially when they walk through Dresden today and see sort of the destruction that's still quite evident throughout that city. But it saved Victor's life, right? The lists did not survive unscathed. I don't imagine any of the summonses that he distributed that morning survived the firestorm. I can't imagine all his prospective killers survived. And, many of their prospective accomplices who probably would have had all these excuses about, the times or just following orders, etc., never got to aid in the murder of Victor Klemperer because they got burned into a crisp.
You heard it from a German, folks. Our American listeners do not have to feel bad about the fire bombing of Dresden. Says so.
At least for Klemperer, it grinds the machinery of state to a halt. As basically people are getting evacuated, he at some point and his entire group just rip off their Stars of David, that he's supposed to wear on his outer clothing. He just kind of abandons his papers and they start walking, right? By the 15th, they've joined a trek of refugees from the burning city and they keep moving, I think, because they think that someone might still know who they are. Mm-hmm. They'd have to know it's Victor Klemperer and they would have to know Victor Klemperer is Jewish. But so they still are being careful. They first, I think, crash with their former housekeeper or something like that. And they don't stay. It's a tiny town. And they're probably afraid that, like, someone is still going to clock them as Jews.
Someone's going to rat them out.
Yeah. And so they first move east, hoping to find the Red Army. But the Wehrmacht is in between them and the Red Army, busy making its last suicidal stand. And so they turn around and head south instead to Bavaria. And on April 29th, 1945, they're in a small village just about 20 miles from Augsburg when they meet the first American tanks. And that is where Yeah, where Viktor Klemperer's time in the Third Reich ends.
So this guy wasn't a priority for deportation or extermination, right? So he kind of bided his time under the suppression of the Nuremberg laws,
yeah,
and of Nazi suppression of Jewish life. And then it was luck of timing and the collapse of the Nazi regime under like basically military defeat that is what saves his life. So he gets to die of something else.
Yeah.
Because he survived the war.
Yeah. And you're exactly right. It's pure luck. The fact that the diary survives is pure luck. The reason we have this story, the reason we know him, the reason he is able to go on to a post-war career is simply because he got lucky where others didn't. The bombs fell at the right time. He was also lucky to be German, frankly, to be a German Jew.
As opposed to like a Polish or a Ukrainian Jew.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Historians can correct me on this, but I think that the number of German Jews who were rounded up and just shot, for instance, in a ditch is pretty small. It was always done with, you know, deportation trains, et cetera, et cetera. That takes time and that takes organization, an organization that can break down as your regime sort of starts losing a war. Whereas in the East, of course, you know, we always think of the Holocaust as being entirely about death camps. It wasn't, right? Like a lot of the Holocaust happened on the sides of highways, and it didn't involve maniacal SS commanders played by Ralph Fiennes in, you know, Spielberg movies. It also involved just like average Germans following orders to gun down women, children, and the elderly, right?
No, it's 21-year-olds shooting a bunch of Polish villagers.
Exactly.
Because they're told to. A lot of it looked more like, you know, just needless slaughters of the kinds that happen in conventional wars. It was obviously like ethnically targeted.
Yeah.
But it didn't all look like the highly coordinated, like industrial scale slaughter that we think of as like the capital H Holocaust.
I mean, the numbers are still staggering, but you're right. The means were more conventional. Exactly. But yeah, he, I mean, one hesitates to use the word lucky, but he is lucky in this way. And so his war ends on April 29th, and by late May, right, the war's over, Hitler's dead, he and Eva leave for Dresden. And on June 10th, they walk through the pulverized sort of new town of Dresden up to the house that he and Eva spent years building. The Nazi who had expropriated him had fled, and so he meets his first Russian soldier, and he's like, yeah, you'd be shocked how easy it is to give that house back to you. And so he gets to be in Dresden. He lived in that house after the war. I'm not sure if he lived there continuously until his death, but he returned to the university teaching job by the end of 1945. He briefly contemplated moving to West Germany, but instead joined the Communist Party and made a go of it in East Germany.
But okay, but after such knowledge, what forgiveness? Like, how do you go back home and live with these fucking people?
Yeah. I mean, he came back to a state that saw itself as a all-out correction and rejection of the Third Reich. And one has to say, whose protagonists at the top echelons of power had, in fact, left Germany largely in 1933 and gone to Moscow. That was not true of West Germany. Just putting that out there. You were much more likely to run into a former camp commander at a West German party conference than you were, you know, in East Germany. Now, Stalinism isn't exactly wonderful either, but like, it's important to note that, like, at least in terms of forgiveness, you know, I don't quite remember what his reasons were against emigrating to the West, but that may have been part of it, that he thought like, well, at least they're making a genuine break with what happened to me, and they're really trying to do better.
It's interesting to me that he joins the Communist Party, because I knew Viktor Klemperer as kind of politically conservative at the outset of the war.
Yeah.
Is that a genuine conversion, or is this just kind of what you do if you're like a ambitious, smart guy in East Germany? Is he just going along to get along, or is he now a communist?
Well, I mean, maybe, but also, you know, it is another totalitarian system and you have to be a member of the party. So you got to join a party, and he joins, it's the only one he can join, really.
He joins the big one, yeah.
Well, he also was a member of parliament for a little while, so there you absolutely had to be a member of the Socialist Unity Party, the SED. And he died in 1960 at age 77. Eva died 10 years earlier, which is significant because he remarried a much younger woman, a Germanist, who, starting in the mid-80s, began publishing selections from Victor's diaries. So still in East Germany, she started publishing these diaries, or at least excerpts from them. And So in 1995, 35 years after his death, 40 years after the bombing of Dresden, Viktor Klemperer's diaries became a bestseller in Germany. I still remember this as a teenager, like these stacks of these massive diaries in the bookstores. And you're like, who is this guy? And like, yeah, he's not around anymore, but here's his story. You know, it's a really kind of a remarkable close to, yeah, a remarkable document and a remarkable life.
Wow.
So, I mean, I don't think there's a happy end to 1933 in any way, shape, or form, but I thought that maybe this will give people at least a little glimmer of hope that there is something afterwards and there are these stories of survival and of endurance that are really, yeah, that should give us hope and that people were probably already envisioning as a possible future on that very frigid December 31st, 1933.
I think that's a great place to leave it. Adrian, thank you so much for taking me along this journey. I've learned so much, and it's really changed my relationship to my own historical moment to learn from you. So thank you.
Thank you for coming with me on this incredibly depressing and dark journey. But your questions and your observations and the connections you've made have really made both 1933 come alive to me and have made this year. I didn't write a 1,200-page diary, unfortunately. But if I ever did, I feel like I'd be a lot more informed thanks to all our conversations about this.
This is what I'm here for, a comedic relief amid the rise of authoritarianism. That's my role in life.
That's the bed with the red promise.
Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you, listeners. And if you've made it all the way through this, my hat is off to you. Reach out and let's have a coffee. There's probably like 5 of you at this point. In Bed With The Right is made possible by hundreds of listeners who support us via patreon.com. Our episodes are produced and edited by Mark Yoshizumi and Katie Lau. Our title music is by Katie Lau.